Metal, stone and glass split asunder, and the ship burst out of the asteroid into space. The inner planet's navy picked him up 90,000 miles outside Mars's orbit. After 7 months of shooting war, the IP patrols were alert but reckless. When the launch failed to answer and give recognition countersigns, it should have been shattered with a blast, and questions could have been asked of the wreckage later. But the launch was small, and the cruiser crew was hot for prize money. They closed and grappled. They found Foyle inside, crawling like a headless worm through a junk heap of spaceship and home furnishings. He was bleeding again, ripe with stinking gangrene, and one side of his head was pulpy. They brought him into the sickbay aboard the cruiser and carefully curtained his tank. Foyle was no sight even for the tough stomachs of lower-deck Navy men. They patched his carcass in the amniotic tank while they completed their tour of duty. On the jet back to Terra, Foyle recovered consciousness and bubbled words beginning with V. He knew he was saved. He knew that only time stood between him and vengeance. The sickbay orderly heard him exulting in his tank and parted the curtains. Foyle's filmed eyes looked up. The orderly could not restrain his curiosity.
"You hear me, man?" he whispered.
Foyle grunted. The orderly bent lower.
"What happened? Who in hell done that to you?"
"What?"
Foyle croaked.
"Don't you know?"
"What? What's the matter, you?"
"Wait a minute, is all."
The orderly disappeared as he jaunted to a supply cabin and reappeared alongside the tank 5 seconds later. Foyle struggled up out of the fluid. His eyes blazed.
"It's coming back, man. Some of it. Jaunt. I couldn't jaunt on the Nomad, me."
"What?"
"I was off my head."
"Man, you didn't have no head left, you."
"I couldn't jaunt. I forgot how was all. I forgot everything, me. Still don't remember much. I—"
He recoiled in terror as the orderly thrust the picture of a hideous tattooed face before him. It was a Maori mask. Cheeks, chin, nose and eyelids were decorated with stripes and swirls. Across the brow was blazoned, "Nomad." Foyle stared, then cried out in agony. The picture was a mirror. The face was his own. Chapter 3.
"Bravo, Mr. Harris. Well done. LES, gentlemen. Never forget. Location, elevation, situation. That's the only way to remember your jaunt coordinates. Être entre le marteau et l'enclume. French. English translation will not follow. Don't jaunt yet, Mr. Peters. Wait your turn. Be patient. You'll all be C-class by and by. Has anyone seen Mr. Foyle? He's missing. Oh, look at that heavenly brown thrasher. Listen to him. Mozart on the wing. Oh, dear, I'm thinking all over the place. Or have I been speaking, gentlemen?"
"Half and half, ma'am."
"It does seem unfair. One-way telepathy is a nuisance. I do apologize for shrapneling you with my thoughts."
"We like it, ma'am. You think pretty."
"How sweet of you, Mr. Gorgas. All right, class, all back to school, and we start again. Has Mr. Foyle jaunted already? I never can keep track of him."
Robin Wedensbury was conducting her re-education class in jaunting on its tour through New York City, and it was as exciting a business for the cerebral cases as it was for the children in her primer class. She treated the adults like children, and they rather enjoyed it. For the past month, they had been memorizing jaunt stages at street intersections, chanting, "LES, ma'am. Location, elevation, situation." She was a tall, lovely Negro girl, brilliant and cultivated, but handicapped by the fact that she was a telesend, a one-way telepath. She could broadcast her thoughts to the world, but could receive nothing. This was a disadvantage that barred her from more glamorous careers, yet suited her for teaching. Despite her volatile temperament, Robin Wedensbury was a thorough and methodical jaunt instructor. The men were brought down from the General War Hospital to the jaunt school, which occupied an entire building in the Hudson Bridge at 42nd Street. They started from the school and marched in a sedate crocodile to the vast Times Square jaunt stage, which they earnestly memorized. Then they all jaunted to the school and back to Times Square. The crocodile reformed, and they marched up to Columbus Circle and memorized its coordinates. Then all jaunted back to school via Times Square and returned by the same route to Columbus Circle. Once more the crocodile formed, and off they went to Grand Army Plaza to repeat the memorizing and the jaunting. Robin was re-educating the patients, all head injuries who had lost the power to jaunt, to the express stops, so to speak, of the public jaunt stages. Later they would memorize the local stops at street intersections. As their horizons expanded and their powers returned, they would memorize jaunt stages in widening circles, limited as much by income as ability. For one thing was certain, you had to actually see a place to memorize it, which meant you first had to pay for the transportation to get you there. Even 3D photographs would not do the trick. The grand tour had taken on a new significance for the rich.
"Location, elevation, situation,"
Robin Wedensbury lectured, and the class jaunted by express stages from Washington Heights to the Hudson Bridge and back again, in primer jumps of a quarter of a mile each, following their lovely Negro teacher earnestly. The little technical sergeant with the platinum skull suddenly spoke in the gutter tongue.
"But there ain't no elevation, ma'am. We're on the ground, us."
"Isn't, Sergeant Logan? Isn't any would be better? I beg your pardon. Teaching becomes a habit, and I'm having trouble controlling my thinking today. The war news is so bad. We'll get to elevation when we start memorizing the stages on top of skyscrapers, Sergeant Logan."
The man with the rebuilt skull digested that, then asked,
"We hear you when you think, is a matter you?"
"Exactly."
"But you don't hear us?"
"Never. I'm a one-way telepath."
"We all hear you, or just I is all?"
"That depends, Sergeant Logan. When I'm concentrating, just the one I'm thinking at. When I'm at loose ends, anybody and everybody, poor souls. Excuse me."
Robin turned and called,
"Don't hesitate before jaunting, Chief Harris. That starts doubting, and doubting ends jaunting. Just step up and bang off."
"I worry sometimes, ma'am,"
a chief petty officer with a tightly bandaged head answered. He was obviously stalling at the edge of the jaunt stage.
"Worry? About what?"
"Maybe there's going to be somebody standing when I arrive. Then there'll be a hell of a real bang, ma'am. Excuse me."
"Now, I've explained that 100 times. Experts have gauged every jaunt stage in the world to accommodate peak traffic. That's why private jaunt stages are small, and the Times Square stage is 200 yards wide. It's all been worked out mathematically, and there isn't one chance in 10 million of a simultaneous arrival. That's less than your chance of being killed in a jet accident."
The bandaged CPO nodded dubiously and stepped up on the raised stage. It was of white concrete, round, and decorated on its face with vivid black-and-white patterns as an aid to memory. In the centre was an illuminated plaque, which gave its name and jaunt coordinates of latitude, longitude, and elevation. At the moment when the bandaged man was gathering courage for his primer jaunt, the stage began to flicker with a sudden flurry of arrivals and departures. Figures appeared momentarily as they jaunted in, hesitated while they checked their surroundings and set new coordinates, and then disappeared as they jaunted off. At each disappearance there was a faint pop, as displaced air rushed into the space formerly occupied by a body.
"Wait, class," Robin called. "There is a rush on. Everybody off the stage, please."
Labourers in heavy work clothes, still spattered with snow, were on their way south to their homes after a shift in the North Woods. 50 white-clad dairy clerks were headed west toward St. Louis. They followed the morning from the Eastern Time Zone to the Pacific Zone. And from eastern Greenland, where it was already noon, a horde of white-collar office workers was pouring into New York for their lunch hour. The rush was over in a few moments.
All right, class, Robin called. We'll continue. Oh, dear, where is Mr. Foyle? He always seems to be missing.
With a face like he's got him, you can't blame him for hiding it, ma'am. Up in the cerebral ward, we call him Boogie.
He does look dreadful, doesn't he, Sergeant Logan? Can't they get those marks off?
They're trying, Miss Robin, but they don't know how yet. It's called tattooing, and it's sort of forgotten is all.
Then how did Mr. Foyle acquire his face?
Nobody knows, Miss Robin. He's up in cerebral because he's lost his mind, him. Can't remember nothing. Me personal, if I had a face like that, I wouldn't want to remember nothing, too.
What a pity. He looks frightful.
Sergeant Logan, do you suppose I've let a thought about Mr. Foyle slip and hurt his feelings?
The little man with the platinum skull considered.
No, ma'am. You wouldn't hurt nobody's feelings, you. And Foyle ain't got none to hurt him. He's just a big dumb ox is all.
I have to be so careful, Sergeant Logan. You see, no one likes to know what another person really thinks about him. We imagine that we do, but we don't. This telescending of mine makes me loathed and lonesome. Please don't listen to me. I'm having trouble controlling my thinking. Ah, there you are, Mr. Foyle. Where in the world have you been wandering?
Foyle had jaunted in on the stage and stepped off quietly, his hideous face averted.
Been practicing me, he mumbled.
Robin repressed the shudder of revulsion in her and went to him sympathetically. She took his arm.
You really should be with us more. We're all friends and having a lovely time. Join in.
Foyle refused to meet her glance. As he pulled his arm away from her sullenly, Robin suddenly realized that his sleeve was soaking wet. His entire hospital uniform was drenched.
Wet? He's been in the rain somewhere. But I've seen the morning weather reports. No rain east of St. Louis.
Then he must have jaunted further than that.
But he's not supposed to be able. He's supposed to have lost all memory and ability to jaunt. He's malingering.
Foyle leapt at her.
Shut up, you!
The savagery of his face was terrifying.
Then you are malingering.
How much do you know?
That you're a fool. Stop making a scene.
Did they hear you?
I don't know. Let go of me.
Robin turned away from Foyle.
All right, class. We're finished for the day. All back to school for the hospital bus. You jaunt first, Sergeant Logan. Remember, L-E-S, location, elevation, situation.
What do you want? Foyle growled. A payoff, you?
Be quiet. Stop making a scene. Now don't hesitate, Chief Harris. Step up and jaunt off.
I want to talk to you.
Certainly not. Wait your turn, Mr. Peters. Don't be in such a hurry.
You're going to report me to the hospital?
Naturally.
I want to talk to you.
No.
They're gone now, all. We got time. I'll meet you in your apartment.
My apartment?
Robin was genuinely frightened.
In Green Bay, Wisconsin.
This is absurd. I've got nothing to discuss with this...
You got plenty, Miss Robin. You got a family to discuss.
Foyle grinned at the terror she radiated.
Meet you in your apartment, he repeated.
You can't possibly know what it is.
She faltered.
Just told you, didn't I?
You couldn't possibly jaunt that far. You...
No.
The mask grinned.
You just told me I was mul... That word. You told the truth, you. We got half an hour. Meet you there.
Robin Wedensbury's apartment was in a massive building, set alone on the shore of Green Bay. The apartment house looked as though a magician had removed it from a city residential area and abandoned it amidst the Wisconsin pines. Buildings like this were a commonplace in the jaunting world. With self-contained heat and light plants and jaunting to solve the transportation problem, single and multiple dwellings were built in desert, forest, and wilderness. The apartment itself was a four-room flat, heavily insulated, to protect neighbours from Robin's telescending. It was crammed with books, music, paintings, and prints, all evidence of the cultured and lonely life, of this unfortunate wrong-way telepath. Robin jaunted into the living room of the apartment a few seconds after Foyle, who was waiting for her with ferocious impatience.
"So now you know for sure,"
he began without preamble. He seized her arm in a painful grip.
"But you ain't gonna tell nobody in the hospital about me, Miss Robin. Nobody.
Let go of me."
Robin lashed him across the face.
"Beast! Savage! Don't you dare touch me!"
Foyle released her and stepped back. The impact of her revulsion made him turn away angrily to conceal his face.
"So you've been malingering. You knew how to jaunt. You've been jaunting all the while you've been pretending to learn in the primer class, taking big jumps around the country, around the world, for all I know."
"Yeah. I got from Times Square to Columbus Circle by way of most anywhere, Miss Robin."
"And that's why you're always missing. But why? Why? What are you up to?"
An expression of possessed cunning appeared on the hideous face.
"I'm holed up in General Hospital, me. It's my base of operations, see? I'm settling something, Miss Robin. I got a debt to pay off, me. I had to find out where a certain ship is. Now I gotta pay her back. Now I rot you, Vorga. I kill you, Vorga. I kill you, filthy."
He stopped shouting and glared at her in wild triumph. Robin backed away in alarm.
"For God's sake, what are you talking about?"
"Vorga. Vorga T-1339. Ever hear of her, Miss Robin? I found out where she is from Bonus and Ewig's ship registry. Bonus and Ewig are out in San Fran. I went there, me, the time when you was learning us the crosstown jaunt stages. Went out to San Fran, me. Found Vorga, me. She's in Vancouver shipyards. She's owned by Prestane at Prestane. Heard of him, Miss Robin? Prestane's the biggest man on Terra, is all. But he won't stop me. I'll kill Vorga, filthy. And you won't stop me neither, Miss Robin."
Foyle thrust his face close to hers.
"Because I cover myself, Miss Robin. I cover every weak spot down the line. I got something on everybody who could stop me before I kill Vorga, including you, Miss Robin."
"No."
"Yeah. I found out where you live. They know up at the hospital I come here and look around. I read your diary, Miss Robin. You got a family on Callisto, mother and two sisters."
"For God's sake!"
"So that makes you alien belligerent. When the war started, you and all the rest was given 1 month to get out of the inner planets and go home. Any which didn't became spies by law."
Foyle opened his hand.
"I got you right here, girl."
He clenched his hand.
"My mother and sisters have been trying to leave Callisto for a year and a half. We belong here. We..."
"Got you right here,"
Foyle repeated.
"You know what they do to spies? They cut information out of them. They cut you apart, Miss Robin. They take you apart, piece by piece."
Robin screamed. Foyle nodded happily and took her shaking shoulders in his hands.
"I got you is all, girl. You can't even run from me, because all I gotta do is tip intelligence, and where are you? There ain't nothing nobody can do to stop me. Not the hospital, or even Mr. Holy Mighty Prestane of Prestane."
"Get out, you filthy, hideous thing! Get out!"
"You don't like my face, Miss Robin. There ain't nothing you can do about that either."
Suddenly he picked her up and carried her to a deep couch. He threw her down on the couch.
"Nothing,"
he repeated. Devoted to the principle of conspicuous waste, on which all society is based, Prestane of Prestane had fitted his Victorian mansion in Central Park with elevators, house phones, dumb waiters, and all the other labour-saving devices which jaunting had made obsolete. The servants in that giant gingerbread castle walked dutifully from room to room, opening and closing doors and climbing stairs. Prestane of Prestane arose, dressed with the aid of his valet and barber, descended to the morning room with the aid of an elevator, and breakfasted, assisted by a butler, footman, and waitresses. He left the morning room and entered his study. In an age when communication systems were virtually extinct, when it was far easier to jaunt directly to a man's office for a discussion than to telephone or telegraph, Prestayne still maintained an antique telephone switchboard with an operator in his study. "Get me Dagenham," he said. The operator struggled, and at last put a call through to Dagenham Couriers, Inc. This was a 100 million credit organization of bonded jaunters, guaranteed to perform any public or confidential service for any principal. Their fee was 1 krone per mile. Dagenham guaranteed to get a courier around the world in 80 minutes. 80 seconds after Prestayne's call was put through, a Dagenham courier appeared on the private jaunt stage outside Prestayne's home, was identified and admitted through the jaunt-proof labyrinth behind the entrance. Like every member of the Dagenham staff, he was an M-class jaunter, capable of teleporting 1,000 miles a jump indefinitely, and familiar with thousands of jaunt coordinates. He was a senior specialist in chicanery and cajolery, trained to the incisive efficiency and boldness that characterized Dagenham Couriers and reflected the ruthlessness of its founder. "Prestayne," he said, wasting no time on protocol.
"I want to hire Dagenham."
"Ready, Prestayne?"
"Not you. I want Saul Dagenham himself.
Mr. Dagenham no longer gives personal service for less than 100,000 krone.
"The amount will be 5 times that."
"Fee or percentage?"
"Both. 250,000 fee and 250,000 guaranteed against 10% of the total amount at risk."
"Agreed. The matter?"
"Pyre."
"Spell it, please."
"The name means nothing to you?"
"No."
"Good. It will to Dagenham. Pyre, capital P-Y-R capital E. Pronounced pyre, as in funeral pyre. Tell Dagenham we've located the pyre. He's engaged to get it, at all costs, through a man named Foyle, Gulliver Foyle."
The courier produced a tiny silver pearl, a memo bead, repeated Prestayne's instructions into it, and left without another word. Prestayne turned to his telephone operator.
"Get me Regis Sheffield," he directed.
10 minutes after the call went through to Regis Sheffield's law office, a young law clerk appeared on Prestayne's private jaunt stage, was vetted and admitted through the maze. He was a bright young man, with a scrubbed face and the expression of a delighted rabbit. "Excuse the delay, Prestayne," he said. "We got your call in Chicago, and I'm still only a D-class 500-miler. Took me a while getting here."
"Is your chief trying a case in Chicago?"
"Chicago, New York, and Washington. He's been on the jaunt from court to court all morning. We fill in for him when he's in another court."
"I want to retain him."
"Honored, Prestayne, but Mr. Sheffield's pretty busy."
"Not too busy for Pyre."
"Sorry, sir, I don't quite..."
"No, you don't. But Sheffield will. Just tell him. Pyre as in funeral pyre, and the amount of his fee."
"Which is?"
250,000 retainer, and 250,000 guaranteed against 10% of the total amount at risk."
"And what performance is required of Mr. Sheffield?"
"To prepare every known legal device for kidnapping a man and holding him against the army, the navy, and the police."
"Quite. And the man?"
"Gulliver Foyle."
The law clerk muttered quick notes into a memo bead, thrust the bead into his ear, listened, nodded, and departed. Prestayne left his study and ascended the plush stairs to his daughter's suite to pay his morning respects. In the homes of the wealthy, the rooms of the female members were blind, without windows or doors, open only to the jaunting of intimate members of the family. Thus was morality maintained, and chastity defended. But since Olivia Prestayne was herself blind to normal sight, she could not jaunt. Consequently, her suite was entered through doors closely guarded by ancient retainers in the Prestayne clan livery. Olivia Prestayne was a glorious albino. Her hair was white silk, her skin was white satin, Her nails, her lips, and her eyes were coral. She was beautiful, and blind in a wonderful way, for she could see in the infrared only, from 7,500 angstroms to 1 millimeter wavelengths. She saw heat waves, magnetic fields, radio waves, radar, sonar, and electromagnetic fields. She was holding her grand levee in the drawing room of the suite. She sat in a brocaded wing chair, sipping tea, guarded by her duenna, holding court, chatting with a dozen men and women standing about the room. She looked like an exquisite statue of marble and coral, her blind eyes flashing as she saw, and yet did not see. She saw the drawing room as a pulsating flow of heat emanations, ranging from hot highlights to cool shadows. She saw the dazzling magnetic patterns of clocks, phones, lights, and locks. She saw and recognized people by the characteristic heat patterns radiated by their faces and bodies. She saw, around each head, an aura of the faint electromagnetic brain pattern, and sparkling through the heat radiation of each body, the ever-changing tone of muscle and nerve. Prestain did not care for the artists, musicians, and fops Olivia kept about her, but he was pleased to see a scattering of society notables this morning. There was a Sears Roebuck, a Gillette, young Sidney Kodak, who would one day be Kodak of Kodak, an Houbigant, Buick of Buick, and R. H. Macy XVI, head of the powerful Saxe-Gimbel clan. Prestain paid his respects to his daughter and left the house. He set off for his clan headquarters at 99 Wall Street in a coach and four, driven by a coachman, assisted by a groom, both wearing the Prestain trademark of red, black and blue. That black pea on a field of scarlet and cobalt was one of the most ancient and distinguished trademarks in the social register, rivaling the 57 of the Hines clan and the RR of the Rolls-Royce dynasty in antiquity. The head of the Prestain clan was a familiar sight to New York jaunters. Iron grey, handsome, powerful, impeccably dressed, and mannered in the old-fashioned style, Prestain of Prestain was the epitome of the socially elect, for he was so exalted in station that he employed coachmen, grooms, hostlers, stable-boys and horses to perform a function for him which ordinary mortals performed by jaunting. As men climbed the social ladder, they displayed their position by their refusal to jaunt. The newly adopted into a great commercial clan rode an expensive bicycle. A rising clansman drove a small sports car. The captain of a sept was transported in a chauffeur-driven antique from the old days, a vintage Bentley or Cadillac, or a towering Lagonda. An heir presumptive, in direct line of succession to the clan chieftainship, staffed a yacht or a plane. Prestain of Prestain, head of the clan Prestain, owned carriages, cars, yachts, planes, and trains. His position in society was so lofty that he had not jaunted in 40 years. Secretly, he scorned the bustling new rich, like the Dagenhams and Sheffields, who still jaunted and were unashamed. Prestain entered the crenellated keep at 99 Wall Street that was Castle Prestain. It was staffed and guarded by his famous jaunt watch, all in clan livery. Prestain walked with the stately gait of a chieftain as they piped him to his office. Indeed, he was grander than a chieftain, as an importunate government official awaiting audience discovered to his dismay. That unfortunate man leaped forward from the waiting crowd of petitioners as Prestain passed. "Mr. Prestain," he began, "I'm from the Internal Revenue Department. I must see you this morning." Prestain cut him short with an icy stare.
"There are thousands of Prestains," he pronounced. "All are addressed as Mr. But I am Prestain of Prestain, head of house and sept, first of the family, chieftain of the clan. I am addressed as Prestain, not Mr. Prestain, Prestain."
He turned and entered his office, where his staff greeted him with a muted chorus. "Good morning, Prestain." Prestain nodded, smiled his basilisk smile, and seated himself behind the enthroned desk, while the jaunt watch skirled their pipes and ruffled their drums. Prestain signalled for the audience to begin. The household equerry stepped forward with a scroll. Prestaine disdained memo beads and all mechanical business devices. "Report on Clan Prestaine Enterprises," the equerry began. "Common stock, high, 201.5. Low, 201.25. Average quotations, New York, Paris, Ceylon, Tokyo." Prestaine waved his hand irritably. The equerry retired, to be replaced by Black Rod. "Another Mr. Presto to be invested, Prestaine?" Prestaine restrained his impatience and went through the tedious ceremony of swearing in the 497th Mr. Presto in the hierarchy of Prestaine Prestos, who managed the shops in the Prestaine retail division. Until recently the man had had a face and body of his own. Now, after years of cautious testing and careful indoctrination, he had been elected to join the Prestos. After 6 months of surgery and psycho-conditioning, he was identical with the other 496 Mr. Prestos, and to the idealized portrait of Mr. Presto, which hung behind Prestaine's dais, a kindly, honest man resembling Abraham Lincoln, a man who instantly inspired affection and trust. Around the world, purchasers entered an identical Prestaine store and were greeted by an identical manager, Mr. Presto. He was rivaled, but not surpassed, by the Kodak clan's Mr. Quick and Montgomery Ward's Uncle Monty. When the ceremony was completed, Prestaine arose abruptly to indicate that the public investiture was ended. The office was cleared of all but the high officials. Prestaine paced, obviously repressing his seething impatience. He never swore, but his restraint was more terrifying than profanity.
"Foil," he said in a suffocated voice, "a common sailor, dirt, dregs, gutter scum. But that man stands between me and—"
"If you please, Prestaine," Black Rod interrupted timidly, "it's 11 o'clock Eastern Time, 8 o'clock Pacific Time."
"What?"
"If you please, Prestaine, may I remind you that there is a launching ceremony at 9, Pacific Time? You are to preside at the Vancouver shipyards."
"Launching?"
"Our new freighter, the Prestaine Princess. It will take some time to establish three-dimensional broadcast contact with the shipyard, so we had better—"
"I will attend in person."
"In person?" Black Rod faltered. "But we cannot possibly fly to Vancouver in an hour, Prestaine. We—"
"I will jaunt,"
Prestaine of Prestaine snapped. Such was his agitation. His appalled staff made hasty preparations. Messengers jaunted ahead to warn the Prestaine offices across the country, and the private jaunt stages were cleared. Prestaine was ushered to the stage within his New York office. It was a circular platform in a black-hung room without windows, a masking and concealment necessary to prevent unauthorized persons from discovering and memorizing coordinates. For the same reason, all homes and offices had one-way windows and confusion labyrinths behind their doors. To jaunt, it was necessary, among other things, for a man to know exactly where he was and where he was going, or there was little hope of arriving anywhere alive. It was as impossible to jaunt from an undetermined starting point as it was to arrive at an unknown destination. Like shooting a pistol, one had to know where to aim and which end of the gun to hold. But a glance through a window or door might be enough to enable a man to memorize the LES coordinates of a place. Prestaine stepped on the stage, visualized the coordinates of his destination in the Philadelphia office, seeing the picture clearly and the position accurately. He relaxed and energized one concentrated thrust of will and belief toward the target. He jaunted. There was a dizzy moment in which his eyes blurred. The New York stage faded out of focus. The Philadelphia stage blurred into focus. There was a sensation of falling down, then up. He arrived. Black Rod and others of his staff arrived a respectful moment later. So in jaunts of 1 and 200 miles each, Prestaine crossed the continent and arrived outside the Vancouver shipping yards at exactly 9 o'clock in the morning, Pacific time. He had left New York at 11 a.m. He had gained 2 hours of daylight. This, too, was a commonplace in a jaunting world. The square mile of unfenced concrete, what fence could bar a jaunter, looked like a white table covered with black pennies neatly arranged in concentric circles. But on closer approach, the pennies enlarged into the 100-foot mouths of black pits, dug deep into the bowels of the earth. Each circular mouth was rimmed with concrete, buildings, offices, check rooms, canteens, changing rooms. These were the take-off and landing pits, the dry dock and construction pits of the shipyards. Spaceships, like sailing vessels, were never designed to support their own weight unaided against the drag of gravity. Normal Terran gravity would crack the spine of a spaceship like an eggshell. The ships were built in deep pits, standing vertically in a network of catwalks and construction grids, braced and supported by anti-gravity screens. They took off from similar pits, riding the anti-grav beams upward like motes mounting the vertical shaft of a searchlight, until at last they reached the Roche limit and could thrust with their own jets. Landing spacecraft cut drive jets and rode the same beams downward into the pits. As the Prestane entourage entered the Vancouver yards, they could see which of the pits were in use. From some, the noses and hulls of spaceships extruded, raised a quarter way or halfway above the ground by the anti-grav screens, as workmen in the pits below brought their aft sections to particular operational levels. Three Prestane V-class transports, Vega, Vestal and Vorga, stood partially raised near the centre of the yards, undergoing flaking and replating, as the heat-lightning flicker of torches around Vorga indicated. At the concrete building marked Entry, the Prestane entourage stopped before a sign that read, "You are endangering your life if you enter these premises unlawfully. You have been warned." Visitor badges were distributed to the party, and even Prestane of Prestane received a badge. He dutifully pinned it on, for he well knew what the result of entry without such a protective badge would be. The entourage continued, winding its way through the pits, until it arrived at O3, where the pit mouth was decorated with bunting in the Prestane colours, and a small grandstand had been erected. Prestane was welcomed, and in turn greeted his various officials. The Prestane band struck up the clan song, bright and brassy, but one of the instruments appeared to have gone insane. It struck a brazen note that blared louder and louder until it engulfed the entire band, and the surprised exclamations. Only then did Prestane realize that it was not an instrument sounding, but the shipyard alarm. An intruder was in the yard, someone not wearing an identification or visitor's badge. The radar field of the protection system was tripped, and the alarm sounded. Through the raucous bellow of the alarm, Prestane could hear a multitude of pops as the yard guards jaunted from the grandstand and took positions around the square mile of concrete field. His own jaunt watch closed in around him, looking wary and alert. A voice began blaring on the PA, coordinating defense. "Unknown in yard! Unknown in yard! At E for Edward 9! E for Edward 9, moving west on foot!" "Someone must have broken in!" Blackrod shouted.
"I'm aware of that," Prestane answered calmly.
"He must be a stranger if he's not jaunting in here."
"I'm aware of that also."
"Unknown approaching D for David 5. D for David 5, still on foot. D for David 5, alert." "What in God's name is he up to?" Blackrod exclaimed.
"You are aware of my rule, sir," Prestane said coldly. "No associate of the Prestane clan may take the name of the divinity in vain. You forget yourself."
"Unknown now approaching C for Charlie 5. Now approaching C for Charlie 5.
Blackrod touched Prestane's arm.
"He's coming this way, Prestane. Will you take cover, please?"
"I will not."
"Prestane, there have been assassination attempts before. Three of them. If..."
"How do I get to the top of this stand?"
"Prestane!"
"Help me up."
Aided by Blackrod, still protesting hysterically, Prestane climbed to the top of the grandstand to watch the power of the Prestane clan in action against danger. Below he could see workmen in white jumpers swarming out of the pits to watch the excitement. Guards were appearing as they jaunted from distant sectors toward the focal point of the action. "Unknown moving south toward B for Baker 3. B for Baker 3. Prestane watched the B3 pit. A figure appeared, dashing swiftly toward the pit, veering, dodging, pulling forward. It was a giant man in hospital blues, with a wild thatch of black hair and a distorted face that appeared in the distance to be painted in livid colours. His clothes were flickering like heat lightning as the protective induction field of the defence system seared him.
"Be for Baker 3 alert! Be for Baker 3! Close in!"
There were shouts and a distant rattle of shots, the pneumatic whine of scope guns. Half a dozen workmen in white leaped for the intruder. He scattered them like ninepins and drove on and on toward B3, where the nose of Vorga showed. He was a lightning bolt, driving through workmen and guards, pivoting, bludgeoning, boring forward implacably. Suddenly he stopped, reached inside his flaming jacket, and withdrew a black canister. With the convulsive gesture of an animal writhing in death throes, he bit the end of the canister and hurled it, straight and true, on a high arc toward Vorga. The next instant he was struck down.
"Explosive! Take cover! Explosive! Take cover! Explosive! Take cover! Prestane!"
Black Rod squawked. Prestane shook him off and watched the canister curve up and then down toward the nose of Vorga, spinning and glinting in the cold sunlight. At the edge of the pit it was caught by the anti-grab beam and flicked upwards as by a giant invisible thumbnail. Up and up and up it whirled, 100, 500, 1,000 feet. Then there was a blinding flash, and an instant later a titanic clap of thunder that smote ears and jarred teeth and bone. Prestane picked himself up and descended the grandstand to the launching podium. He placed his finger on the launching button of the Prestane Princess.
"Bring me that man, if he's still alive," he said to Black Rod.
He pressed the button.
"I christen thee the Prestane Power,"
he called in triumph. Chapter 4. The Star Chamber in Castle Prestane was an oval room, with ivory panels picked out with gold, high mirrors and stained-glass windows. It contained a gold organ with robot organist by Tiffany, a gold-tooled library with android librarian on library ladder, a Louis Kahn's desk with android secretary, before a manual memo-bid recorder, an American bar with robot bartender. Prestane would have preferred human servants, but androids and robots kept secrets.
"Be seated, Captain Yeovil," he said courteously. "This is Mr. Regis Sheffield, representing me in this matter. That young man is Mr. Sheffield's assistant."
"Bunny's my portable law library," Sheffield grunted.
Prestane touched a control. The still life in the Star Chamber came alive. The organist played, the librarian sorted books, the secretary typed, the bartender shook drinks. It was spectacular, and the impact, carefully calculated by industrial psychometrists, established control for Prestane and put visitors at a disadvantage.
"You spoke of a man named Foyle, Captain Yeovil," Prestane prompted.
Captain Peter Yang Yeovil of Central Intelligence was a lineal descendant of the learned Mencius and belonged to the intelligence tongue of the Inner Planet's armed forces. For 200 years, the IPAF had entrusted its intelligence work to the Chinese, who, with a 5,000-year history of cultivated subtlety behind them, had achieved wonders. Captain Yang Yeovil was a member of the dreaded Society of Paper Men, an adept of the Tientsin image-makers, a master of superstition, and fluent in the secret speech. He did not look Chinese. Yang Yeovil hesitated, fully aware of the psychological pressures operating against him. He examined Prestane's ascetic, basilisk face, Sheffield's blunt, aggressive expression, and the eager young man named Bunny, whose rabbit features had an unmistakable oriental cast. It was necessary for Yeovil to re-establish control, or effect a compromise. He opened with a flanking movement.
"Are we related anywhere within 15 degrees of consanguinity?"
he asked Bunny, in the Mandarin dialect.
"I am of the house of the learned Mengse, whom the barbarians call Mencius."
"Then we are hereditary enemies," Bunny answered in faltering Mandarin, "for the formidable ancestor of my line was deposed as governor of Shantung in 342 BC by the earth-pig Mengse."
"With all courtesy, I shave your ill-formed eyebrows,"
Yang Yovil said. Most respectfully, I singe your snaggle teeth. Bunny laughed.
Come, sirs, Prestain protested.
We are reaffirming a 3,000-year blood feud, Yang Yovil explained to Prestain, who looked sufficiently unsettled by the conversation and the laughter which he did not understand. He tried a direct thrust.
When will you be finished with foil? He asked. What foil?
Sheffield cut in.
What foil have you got? There are 13 of that name associated with the Clan Prestain.
An interesting number. Did you know I was a master of superstition? Some day I must show you the Mirror and Listen mystery. I refer to the foil involved in a reported attempt on Mr. Prestain's life this morning.
Prestain, Prestain corrected. I am not Mr. I am Prestain of Prestain.
3 attempts have been made on Prestain's life, Sheffield said. You'll have to be more specific.
3 this morning? Prestain must have been busy. Yang Yovil sighed. Sheffield was proving himself a resolute opponent. The intelligence man tried another diversion. I do wish our Mr. Presto had been more specific.
Your Mr. Presto?
Prestain exclaimed. Oh, yes. Didn't you know one of your 500 Prestos was an agent of ours? That's odd. We took it for granted you'd find out, and went ahead with a confusion operation. Prestain looked appalled. Yang Yovil crossed his legs and continued to chat breezily. That's the basic weakness in routine intelligence procedure. You start finessing before finesse is required.
He's bluffing, Prestain burst out. None of our Prestos could possibly have any knowledge of Gulliver Foyle.
Thank you, Yang Yovil smiled. That's the foil I want. When can you let us have him?
Sheffield scowled at Prestain, and then turned on Yang Yovil.
Who's us?
He demanded.
Central Intelligence.
Why do you want him?
Do you make love to a woman before or after you take your clothes off?
That's a damned impertinent question to ask.
And so was yours. When can you let us have foil?
When you show cause.
To whom?
To me.
Sheffield hammered a heavy forefinger against his palm. This is a civilian matter concerning civilians. Unless war material, war personnel, or the strategy and tactics of a war in being are involved, civilian jurisdiction shall always prevail.
303 Terran Appeals, 191, murmured Bunny. The Nomad was carrying war material.
The Nomad was transporting platinum bullion to Mars Bank, Prestain snapped. If money is a...
I am leading this discussion, Sheffield interrupted. He swung around on Yang Yovil.
Name the war material.
This blunt challenge knocked Yang Yovil off balance. He knew that the crux of the Nomad situation was the presence on board the ship of 20 pounds of pyre, the total world supply, which was probably irreplaceable now that its discoverer had disappeared. He knew that Sheffield knew that they both knew this. He had assumed that Sheffield would prefer to keep pyre unnamed, and yet here was the challenge to name the unnameable. He attempted to meet bluntness with bluntness.
All right, gentlemen, I'll name it now. The Nomad was transporting 20 pounds of a substance called pyre.
Prestain started. Sheffield silenced him.
What's pyre?
According to our reports.
From Prestain's Mr. Presto?
Oh, that was bluff.
Yang Yovil laughed, and momentarily regained control.
According to intelligence, pyre was developed for Prestain by a man who subsequently disappeared. Pyre is a mishmetal, a pyrophore. That's all we know for a fact, but we've had vague reports about it. Unbelievable reports from reputable agents. If a fraction of our inferences are correct, pyre could make the difference between a victory and a defeat.
Nonsense. No war material has ever made that much difference.
No. I cite the fission bomb of 1945. I cite the Null-G anti-gravity installations of 2022. Tally's all-field radar trip screen of 2194. Material can often make the difference,
especially when there's a chance of the enemy getting it first.
There's no such chance now.
Thank you for admitting the importance of Pyre.
I admit nothing. I deny everything.
Central Intelligence is prepared to offer an exchange, a man for a man. The inventor of Pyre for Gallifoyle.
You've got him?
Sheffield demanded.
Then why badger us for Foyle?
Because we've got a corpse, Yang Yeovil flared. The Outer Satellites Command had him on Lascelles for 6 months, trying to carve information out of him. We pulled him out with a raid at a cost of 79% casualties. We rescued a corpse. We still don't know if the Outer Satellites were having a cynical laugh at our expense, letting us recapture a body. We still don't know how much they ripped out of him. Prestane sat bolt upright at this. His merciless fingers tapped slowly and sharply.
"Damn it!" Yang Yeovil stormed.
"Can't you recognize a crisis, Sheffield? We're on a tightrope. What the devil are you doing backing Prestane in this shabby deal? You're the leader of the Liberal Party, Terra's arch-patriot. You're Prestane's political arch-enemy. Sell him out, you fool, before he sells us all out!"
"Captain Yeovil," Prestane broke in with icy venom. "These expressions cannot be countenanced."
"We want and need Pyre," Yang Yeovil continued. "We will have to investigate that 20 pounds of Pyre, rediscover the synthesis, learn to apply it to the war effort. And all this before the OS beats us to the punch, if they haven't already. But Prestane refuses to cooperate. Why? Because he's opposed to the party in power. He wants no military victories for the Liberals. He'd rather we lost the war for the sake of politics, because rich men like Prestane never lose. Come to your senses, Sheffield. You've been retained by a traitor. What in God's name are you trying to do?"
Before Sheffield could answer, there was a discreet tap on the door of the Star Chamber, and Saul Dagenham was ushered in. Time was when Dagenham was one of the Inner Planet's research wizards, a physicist with inspired intuition, total recall, and a sixth-order computer for a brain. But there was an accident at Tycho Sands, and the fission blast that should have killed him did not. Instead, it turned him dangerously radioactive. It turned him hot. It transformed him into a 25th-century Typhoid Mary. He was paid 25,000 kroner a year by the Inner Planet's government to take precautions which they trusted him to carry out. He avoided physical contact with any person for more than 5 minutes per day. He could not occupy any room other than his own for more than 30 minutes a day. Commanded and paid by the IP to isolate himself, Dagenham had abandoned research and built the Colossus of Dagenham Couriers, Inc. When Yang Yeovil saw the short blonde cadaver with leaden skin and death's head smile enter the Star Chamber, he knew he was assured of defeat in this encounter. He was no match for the three men together. He arose at once.
"I am getting an Admiralty order for Foyle," he said. "As far as intelligence is concerned, all negotiations are ended. From now on, it's war."
"Captain Yeovil is leaving."
Prestane called to the jaunt watch officer who had guided Dagenham in.
"Please see him out through the maze."
Yang Yeovil waited until the officer stepped alongside him and bowed. Then, as the man courteously motioned to the door, Yang Yeovil looked directly at Prestane, smiled ironically, and disappeared with a faint pop.
"Prestane!" Bunny exclaimed. "He jaunted. This room isn't blind to him. He—"
"Evidently," Prestane said icily. "Inform the master of the household," he instructed the amazed watch officer. "The coordinates of the Star Chamber are no longer secret. They must be changed within 24 hours. And now, Mr. Dagenham."
"1 minute," Dagenham said. "There's that Admiralty order."
Without apology or explanation, he disappeared too. Prestane raised his eyebrows.
"Another party to the Star Chamber's secret," he murmured. "But at least he had the tact to conceal his knowledge until the secret was out."
Dagenham reappeared.
"No point wasting time going through the motions of the maze," he said.
I'll give them orders in Washington. They'll hold Yeovil up. 2 hours guaranteed, 3 hours probably, 4 hours possible.
How will they hold him up? Bunny asked.
Dagenham gave him his deadly smile. Standard FFCC operation of Dagenham couriers. Fun, fantasy, confusion, catastrophe. We'll need all 4 hours. Damn. I've disrupted your dolls, Prestane.
The robots were suddenly capering in lunatic fashion as Dagenham's hard radiation penetrated their electronic systems.
No matter. I'll be on my way.
Foil?
Prestane asked.
Nothing yet.
Dagenham grinned his death's head smile.
He's really unique. I've tried all the standard drugs and routines on him. Nothing. Outside he's just an ordinary spaceman, if you forget the tattoo on his face. But inside he's got steel guts. Something's got hold of him, and he won't give.
What's got hold of him? Sheffield asked.
I hope to find out.
How?
Don't ask. You'd be an accessory.
Have you got a ship ready, Prestane?
Prestane nodded.
I'm not guaranteeing there'll be any Nomad for us to find, but we'll have to get a jump on the Navy if there is.
Law ready, Sheffield?
Ready.
I'm hoping we won't have to use it.
I'm hoping too, but again, I'm not guaranteeing.
All right, stand by for instructions. I'm on my way to crack foil.
Where have you got him?
Dagenham shook his head.
This room isn't secure.
He disappeared. He jaunted Cincinnati, New Orleans, Monterey, to Mexico City, where he appeared in the psychiatry wing of the giant hospital of the combined Terran universities. Wing was hardly an adequate name for this section, which occupied an entire city in the metropolis which was the hospital. Dagenham jaunted up to the 43rd floor of the therapy division and looked into the isolated tank where Foil floated, unconscious. He glanced at the distinguished bearded gentleman in attendance.
"Hello, Fritz.
Hello, Saul.
Hell of a thing. The head of psychiatry minding a patient for me.
I think we owe you favours, Saul.
You still brooding about Tycho Sands, Fritz?
I'm not.
Am I louse in your wing with radiation?
I've had everything shielded.
Ready for the dirty work?
I wish I knew what you were after.
Information.
And you have to turn my therapy department into an inquisition to get it?
That was the idea.
Why not use ordinary drugs?
Tried them already. No good. He's not an ordinary man.
You know this is illegal.
I know. Changed your mind? Want to back out? I can duplicate your equipment for $250,000.
No, Saul. We'll always owe you favours.
Then let's go. Nightmare theatre first. They trundled the tank down a corridor and into a 100-foot square padded room. It was one of therapy's bypassed experiments. Nightmare theatre had been an early attempt to shock schizophrenics back into the objective world by rendering the fantasy world into which they were withdrawing uninhabitable. But the shattering and laceration of patients' emotions had proved to be too cruel and dubious a treatment. For Dagenham's sake, the head of psychiatry had dusted off the 3D visual projectors and reconnected all sensory projectors. They decanted Foil from his tank, gave him a reviving shot, and left him in the middle of the floor. They removed the tank, turned off the lights, and entered the concealed control booth. There they turned on the projectors. Every child in the world imagines that its fantasy world is unique to itself. Psychiatry knows that the toys and terrors of private fantasies are a common heritage shared by all mankind. Fears, guilts, terrors and shames could be interchanged from one man to the next, and none would notice the difference. The therapy department at Combined Hospital had recorded thousands of emotional tapes and boiled them down to one all-inclusive, all-terrifying performance in Nightmare Theatre. Foil awoke, panting and sweating, and never knew that he had awakened. He was in the clutch of the serpent-haired, bloody-eyed Eumenides. He was pursued, entrapped, precipitated from heights, burned, flayed, bowstringed, vermin-covered, devoured. He screamed, he ran.
The radar hobble field in the theatre clogged his steps and turned them into the ghastly slow motion of dream running. And through the cacophony of grinding, shrieking, moaning, pursuing that assailed his ears, muttered the thread of a pursuit.